Hello and welcome to episode 76 of the Payers and Players podcast. My name is Robert, and we've got an exciting guest here with us today. Scott, you want to take a minute to introduce our guest?
Sure. It's Tiffany Milner. Tiffany was, she grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she was a top 10 junior in the country. She played collegiately at Texas A&M, where she made all conference three times, and she won the Arthur Ashe Leadership and Sportsmanship Award. Tiffany, can you tell us a little bit about what you're currently doing?
Yeah, thanks, you guys. It's good to be here. I've been working with the USTA Intermountain Section for this is my 15th year this summer, so that'll make 15. I started that right out of college at A&M. So my role there is the junior programs manager. So that just means that I oversee, the tournaments, the competitive pathway, training camps, deal with coaches, tournament directors, national staff, district staff. So, but everything 18 and under. I don't touch the adult space, but that's someone else. But been doing that for about 15 years. And then although I work for the Intermountain Section, I live in outside of the section in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, where I am affiliated with a tennis academy here as well that my daughter attends. My daughter's 11 years old. So I get to have a little boots on the ground work with them sometimes, which is nice.
You know, Tiffany, the Scott's introduction, it was great. The first thing that hits my mind is both a junior in Little Rock who then plays at Texas A&M. As a parent, that immediately raises my interest in hearing how that happened. So how does a young junior from Little Rock, mm-hmm. you know, Little Rock's on the furthest west part of the southern section. You were probably right. Having to go to Cary, North Carolina, and travel long distances to play tournaments. How in the world did you go from Little Rock into playing such a high level at Texas A&M? What was your beginning in the 8, 9s, and 10s?
Mm-hmm. So I started when I was 8. Actually, my mom at the time had asked me, said, all right, what do you want to do? You need an activity. And I said, I want to do gymnastics. And she said, no, you're not going to get to do gymnastics. You're going to try golf or tennis first. And she said, those are two lifelong sports. So you try one of those. So I just flipped a coin and picked tennis, started in a park in Little Rock. Instantly fell in love, did not want to play golf at that point. And I found myself, so that was at age 8. By 10, I was fully, I wouldn't say I was fully committed, but I was. I mean, I just loved the game. I grew up playing against a backboard, like many of us did back then, my dad would take me to the side of it was a Kmart actually. And I said, I want to go hit, but I had no one to hit with. And so he took me on the side of a Kmart, and it's a huge, huge wall. And it was like the best time ever. So I loved doing that. I was pretty self-driven early on because of my love for tennis. I did meet someone I came from a pretty low, I would say, low-income family. My parents are divorced. Both struggled with various things. And my brother and I, we kind of bounced around from family to family. And tennis is an expensive sport, so I definitely know that now. And I met a man in Little Rock who was able to, he saw me play, and he sort of took me under his wing, if you will. And he said, you know, you could do something, you could be something, you have the right attitude. And so he was extremely well known in the state of Arkansas through the tennis world. He had, I guess, was born and raised there, but came through and knew a lot of people. So he sent out letters out to the entire state saying, hey, we need to help this little girl. And he collected money and went into an account just for me to help me with travel through the southern section, and then obviously at the national level. So he kind of helped kickstart things, I think, for me and got me, introduced me to the right people to get me free memberships into clubs so I can play it, you know, in the wintertime. I will say that you mentioned Arkansas is, yes, it's not like it, you know, back then and even not so long ago when our sections were quite divided, you know, we couldn't cross lines. We couldn't cross over to Texas or Oklahoma, you know, or Missouri to go play tournaments. We were having to kind of stay within our region of the Southern section. So not a ton of players. So one of the things that I try to tell my daughter and I try to tell kids now, I said, the thing that got me good actually was match play and match play against adults, which is kind of fascinating if you think about how, you know, kids do it nowadays. I said, I used to tell my daughter, I said, you know, I played every single Thursday, I played against a 67-year-old man and we played singles. I was 10, 11, you know, 11 years old. We would play on clay courts and he was a member at the club. So I got to just kind of mooch off of his court time. And we would play every single Thursday at 4:30. And I did this regularly. And, you know, someone like this, I was playing now at, you know, playing the Southern sectionals, you know, and things. And I'd play him still on Thursdays. And he taught, like, I had to learn how to beat somebody who couldn't move, but who could put the ball where they wanted to, played a different game style. So I played a lot of different people like that kind of growing up. And as a junior, I did that every Sunday. Sunday night was my day that I called my Rolodex of people. I scheduled my matches from Monday through Saturday, and I did it again on Sunday. So it was a ton of match play growing up, which was fun.
Scott, go ahead. I got so many questions after that.
Oh, yeah. Scott. I mean, I've never heard anybody say that they grew up, you know, their academy was the Kmart wall. So
yeah, what a great story. Go ahead, Scott. Yeah.
I love how if there's a will, there's a way, you know. And so instead of, you know, finding excuses, oh, it's too expensive or it's, you know, whatever, go find a wall and hit against. You know, that's one of the things that we have a struggle with here is trying to find a wall because there just really aren't any. Never thought of using the Kmart, so have to put that one in the bag.
So Tiffany, I'm wondering, you're 11, and by the way, this may be the best opening to the show we've ever had, Scott. But when you talk about you're 11, you have a Rolodex of people to call. You were 11 scheduling those matches like that?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, my parents were divorced. My mom was working multiple jobs. My dad struggled in his own way. My brother and I had to kind of grow up quite early. And like I said, we were really not in one place for more than a couple of days. So I will say my mom did drive that at first. You know, she kind of said, like, you need to, you know, you can't go take lessons. I can't afford to put you in an academy. I can't do all these things. And so this man who I had met early on, he also helped me sort of build that Rolodex and said, hey, people want to, they'll play with you. You know, all you have to do is just make the ask. So yeah, I had a little spreadsheet of people and numbers, and I picked up the phone. It was every Sunday night. I created the schedule for me for that week, and then I'd take it to my mom and I'd say, okay, here's where I gotta go this week. And it was Monday, you're at the Racquet Club, and on Tuesday you're at Pleasant Valley, and at Wednesday you're at the Athletic Club, and Thursday you're at the Country Club, of, you know. So it was a different place, and she would find a way to get me there. And yeah.
And so now you're going to national tournaments or intersection Southerns. You're probably going to Mobile. You're probably going to Cary. What did that look like? Were you going with your parents? Were you riding with a group of kids? Were you, how was that happening?
Yeah. So we did start doing it where I would go with more of like other families. We would try to do this sort of kind of, hey, we'll take your kid this time if, you know, you take mine next time, you know, that kind of thing. So it was a lot of a lot of carpooling, and we went a lot over to Georgia. That was a huge spot. But yeah, I would say my parents did not go often to tournaments. They did a little bit more at the beginning. I know my dad took me to a zonals and my mom took me to some sectional tournaments. But back then, if you were playing any national level tournaments, you could, they actually offered housing at all the national tournaments. So I started doing that when I was 13. So any national event that I would go to, the tournament director would, it was part of the tournament. They obviously don't do it now, but you would just say, I'm signing up for housing. The tournament director would find a host family or housing families, and then they would put us, you know, put all these players into, and so I would travel by myself on the plane, and I would meet up with the tournament director or the tournament administrator, get them to show me who I'm staying with. And I did that from age 13 to 18. So I did that at every single national tournament. And I would say when I was 12, might've been the last time my mom took me to a tournament. And partly, I think, not that you asked this part of it, but I think, you know, by age 8 to 12 is when I started to have, you know, I found a love, but then I started to, you know, play and practice, and I actually got okay. I got pretty good, and now I'm starting to play these national tournaments, and I'm going to Easter Bowl, and I'm going to hard courts, and that's when I think it got harder for my mom as a tennis parent. My dad was a little disassociated from you know, us, and we didn't see him as much, but it got a lot harder on her, and to the point where she kind of said, she's like, Tiffany, I can't watch anymore. It makes me physically ill. And I didn't understand it at the time. So, but in reality, it was a blessing because I did go with so many other people, and it created some independent experiences for me that from an early age. And I loved housing. I loved traveling by myself. I had one bad experience, I would say, and it was the second time I went. I traveled up to Chicago, and this was before 9/11, because I'm so old, where you could go to the gate, and my mom said, okay, you're going to go there. It's going to be like a 65-year-old man. He's a tournament director. He's going to be in a big white van. It's going to have the tennis center on the side of the van, and he's going to meet you at baggage claim. And I said, okay. And so
how old were you?
I was 13, just turned 13. I got into Chicago. I have my big tennis bag on, carried it on. And on the side of your tennis bags, you know, you have name tags, and it's, you know, my name was probably on it. I don't remember, but I had a lot of bag tags. And so I see these two younger men, and they're walking kind of in the terminal, like they're walking past me, and they say, Tiffany, you know, Tiffany Clifford, which was my maiden name. And I said, yes. And they're like, oh, we're here to pick you up. And I'm by myself. And immediately I just kind of thought, that's kind of weird, because these two like 22-year-old, 3-year-old guys. But I said, okay. And they're like, yeah, you're here for the tennis, right? Yes. So do you have a bag? Yes, I got to go to baggage claim. So we all kind of walk together to baggage claim. I get my bag. I have no cell phone or anything like that. So I get my bag, and they, again, all of this is starting to kind of not add up. And I go, this is weird. This is not the story that I was told of how I'm supposed to meet these, you know, these people. So I end up going out. I get my bag. I go out to the parking lot, and I say, these two still guys, they're not really giving me much information. They take me out to a red Mustang. And I just stand in the parking lot in the middle, and there are people, thankfully, but they open up the trunk, and they say, okay, let me help you with your bags. And I just said, nope, sorry. I got to go back in. I have to go back inside. This is not right. And they were like, no, we're here to pick you up for the tennis tournament, blah, blah. And I said, no, everything about this is wrong. You know, and I remember telling them, like, I can't get in the car with you. Well, lo and behold, they finally started to open up about, and I sort of tested them on everything, you know, like who are you? And they ended up saying, okay, I'm so sorry. I know everything. You're supposed to be housing with the Aquinos. You were supposed to be picked up in a white van, but the white van wouldn't, the battery died this morning. My dad is the tournament director. He's the one who was supposed to pick you up. And because he was dealing with stuff, they started answering enough questions that I said, okay, it makes sense now. But it was a good test for my parents and my mom to say, okay, if I can do that, and I had a good enough head on my shoulders to be aware of those differences. And she's like, yep, you're good. You can travel by yourself from here on out. So.
Wow.
Kind of an interesting one. Yeah.
What a story. Well, one of the things I wonder, you know, hearing your background, and now you see a lot of junior tennis players who some have the same background as you, but most it's quite easy for them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that affects their development as a tennis player when they didn't have to go through the hard times that you had to go through, where really everything's kind of the way is paved for them?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's a hard one, because I oftentimes think, I'm like, well, does someone have to go through all of that? And I spoke a little bit about a tennis parent, but you know, she struggled, and actually it got quite bad and quite abusive with me, and both physically, mentally, emotionally. And so it's affected our relationship now as an adult, but which I can share, and I'm completely open about now. But it started early on, because she knew the pressures and things. And so I oftentimes thought, as a parent of my own, I have two kids. I have an 11-year-old who plays tennis. She's playing, you know, she just turned 11, and she's went through the entire Net Generation play tracker. She's on, you know, she's now probably she plays kind of level threes to level sixes. So I oftentimes thought, well, did I kind of came out okay. I don't know if I, not amazing, but I had a good head on my shoulders. I liked tennis. It got me opportunities that I never thought I would have. Do I have to do that to my kid? Do I have to abuse my child? Do I have to, or can I do this without creating such adversity in her life? I think it can happen, hopefully. I mean, I don't know. I'll let you know in 7 more years, or I guess 13 more years, maybe, when my daughter is hopefully still playing the sport of tennis. But you know, I think creating some, I think our children now are, we, I want to give my child everything, right? And I think we all want to do that, maybe as parents. And I think it's, for me, I try to create some adversity in her life, you know, not like, I try to put a little bit more ownership on her. So I, even if she just turned 11 2 months ago, I let her try to dictate. You know, we have these tournaments coming up. Do you want to play these? Do you not? I'm not signing, like, I will sign you up because you don't have access to a phone and a credit card. But I try to put things a little bit more on her and let her dictate. And I'll say, and I want to align those, and I need her to see that. I need to align those with what her goals are. And we've had a lot of discussions about that. So I will allow you to make choices, but if you give me what your goals are, I want to help steer you in making choices that align with the goals that you're setting for yourself, not me.
Yeah. So that they're running it. The challenge is, you often hear players or coaches mention that American players are soft, mm-hmm. and that they, you know, that soft mentality, that everything handed to them, creates a bit of an entitlement. And mm-hmm. you see a lot of the foreign players who come and who had to fight and scrap,
mm-hmm.
When they arrive, it's not nearly as dramatic or difficult to get them to continue to work hard. And so do you think the two are connected, them getting the what they need or the way being paid for them? Or do you think that it's just individual people, and regardless of the background, they can be handed it and be okay, and they cannot be handed it and not be. What's your opinion on how a lot of coaches feel like American players can, even the desire to not be coached hard or talked to aggressively, so that they do improve?
Yeah, I think some of it, I think some is ingrained in you, I believe. I mean, I think, but you know, I've seen enough players even come out of the academy that my daughter's in, and some of the really great players that have come out of it, I wouldn't say that they've, you know, had a silver spoon in their mouth their entire life, but they've had opportunities at their fingertips, you know, and they come out quite successful. I think that's some of their personality. I think that's, it was just a little bit ingrained in them. I think, you know, and we hear this a lot, and if you can create a player or to have some grit in them, I think that piece, and I feel, kind of sets players apart, you know. And whether or not you got grit because it's ingrained in you, or it's developed because of, you know, outside circumstances, you know, I don't know. I mean, and there's pros on the tour now that it, you know, wasn't everything wasn't a struggle. Not their entire upbringing was a struggle, and they had it. I think they had that little grit that was embedded in them. So I don't know. I mean, but if you don't, I need to try to create that. Right now, my daughter has a lot of opportunities at her fingertips, and she has all the resources that I can provide. But how can I create moments to, you know, make her feel like a little bit of struggle and make her overcome those? I mean, yesterday is a perfect example. She was hitting with her primary coach, and I almost went to her primary coach, and at the beginning of but almost went to the coach and said, I need you to create an environment in this next hour that is going to make her struggle. And I want her to struggle. I want her to figure out how to overcome those moments, because that is the sport that we've chosen. You know, it's very, very rare that you're going to have a player who's, you know, they're playing the best tennis every single point, and they're just on fire. Now you can have a couple of those moments, but this sport we know is about mistakes. So I almost had this coach do that, and ironically, he kind of did it on his own, thankfully. And we talked about it afterwards, and they had to overcome some things. And I said, you know, I almost went to you saying, please create an environment for the next hour where you make her feel pain, and not physical pain, but mental pain. Make her struggle. Make her feel like she has to overcome something that maybe she's never done. And it naturally happened, and it was great. She had to, you know, I think we have to, as parents, we have to be okay and almost in creating those environments so they can figure out how to get through those and how to work through those.
Productive struggle. Productive struggle.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So in tournaments, where do you see kids fall apart mentally, and how can they improve that in their practice conditions? So, you know, if a kid's cheating, or, you know, something's not going their way, you know, how do you think that we should be instilling that in their training and development?
Well, I think trying to create these environments where, you know, I have coached a little, and I'm quite busy now, so I don't coach a ton anymore. But, you know, there were moments where in the past where I would have a group of players, and, you know, and coaches do this, I think. I don't. But you say, okay, let's just say they're playing we're playing up and down, right? You know, it's a very typical game and programs, academies. You're playing up and down, you know, king of the court style. You know, it's me versus you, and I'm trying to get to the top court. And whatever the scenario is, maybe the scenario is nothing. Maybe it's just we feed up the middle, play up the middle, and now we play the point out. And like 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes in, no matter, they don't know, the kid doesn't know that we're going to say this, but we say, all right, whatever your score is, flip it. It's reverse. So if you just got up 9-4, you've been battling, you've been playing really well, you're up 9-4. All right, you guys flip it, reverse the score. It's now 4-9. Well, oh my gosh, you see some of these kids come unraveled. They're like, what? It's like, no, like, deal with it. You get cheated all the time, you know? So, or vice versa. Maybe it's kind of like, you know, the same thing. I've done it where, all right, we play, I'll let them battle for, you know, 7, 8, 10 minutes, whatever it is. And then I say, everybody, okay, stop, whatever your score is. I said, next point wins. And that's what determines who moves up and who moves down. And it doesn't matter. Were you up 11-1 and you just lost the last point on a net court and you have to move down now? I don't know. Life's not fair. Like, it's so creating some of it's good. Like, I don't want to, I'm not going to make them suffer all the time, but creating these little moments where you're kind of putting these kids in some tough situations because they're going to play people who are cheating. They're going to play people who are changing scores. They're going to play people who are taunting. They're, you know, so if we can create some environments in our practice sessions and say, okay, here's how we're going to overcome this. Here's some tools that we can use. You know, maybe the tool for you is you need to take 3 deep breaths. And now those 3 deep breaths, you need to slow down. Someone else, it could be, they need to lash out. They need to get this big scream out and say like, ah, and then, you know, they get it out and then all of a sudden they're done. Right. So, I think as coaches, as parents, but certainly as coaches, I think we can look at those players and as individuals and try to figure out what's the best tools and tactics to try to overcome some of those difficult situations.
And they're going to happen.
Oh yeah.
So having them ready for them, that's one of the things that amazes me when you go to a lot of the high level tournaments. A lot of the drama you saw at the low level tournaments just doesn't happen. The high level tournament players have found coping mechanisms where the entry level tournament players, it's never happened. And it's a big deal to the parents. It's a big deal to the kids. And then you go to level 1, 2s, and 3s and you just don't see it very much. But when you do see it, they know how to cope with it. So I think it's because of what you just said. Players are being put in that position over and over. So tell me this. Throughout your career, give me kind of a highlight now of 14s through 18s, what that looked like from a playing and success standpoint. Because if you went to A&M, it had to have been quite successful. And then were there any injuries along the way, and how'd you cope with that?
Yeah, so when I was 14, I was top 10 in the country, and I got a letter in the mail offering to come to a tennis academy and live. And so I went and checked it out.
Do you want to say which one?
Yeah, happy to. It's John Newcomb's Nukes down in Texas. So I was from Arkansas, I was from Little Rock, and then so this didn't seem too far away. But as I mentioned earlier, by this point in my junior tennis career, the relationship between my mom and myself, my relationship was fine, but the way that she was handling the pressures of getting better, and she kind of saw that as that was my ticket out. So unfortunately, I mean, I was 14, I was top 10 in the country, and I never hated tennis more. I hated what tennis was making my mom, like how it was making her towards me. And I know now as an adult, she just knew I couldn't go to college without tennis. I couldn't get out of a, you know, bad environment without tennis. She just didn't know how to handle those pressures. And so at this moment, now I'm 14, I'm top 10 in the country. You know, I've played every single L1 that you can play. I'm kind of on this track. I get this letter, and it just, it seemed like the most perfect time because of kind of where she was at and where I was. And it was just a very, very unhealthy home life, quite honestly. So she was, I got a full scholarship there, and that was the only way that we could obviously make it work. And we went down there, checked it out, and then I moved there when I was 15. So it would have been my sophomore year, and I stayed there until I was a senior. I stayed there throughout the summers. I worked, I stayed there. Yeah, I never really went home. I went home, I think, at Christmas time. So that was about it. And it was great. I was able to meet the director at the time. He was his name was Bob McKinley. He was he helped me tremendously, let's put it that way. And he kind of knew my situation, and I still was traveling, but I was still traveling on my own. The academy was going, they were traveling to these L1s, but I was still traveling on my own because we couldn't afford it. So I would go on by myself. I would still continue to stay with housing families, but training at the academy, I went to regular high school there. So we went to regular high school, but we got out early with the high school that was there in New Braunfels. And then by the time at that moment, you could start getting phone calls from college coaches on July 1st between your junior and senior year. Things are obviously different now, but I got all my calls that summer between my junior and senior year, and I took 5 recruiting visits. So you can take 5, and I took all 5 of them. That was one of the things.
Where'd you go? What were they?
I went to a bunch of Southern schools. I went to Alabama, Auburn, LSU, Arkansas, and Texas A&M. So got offers to almost all of those. And I thought I was going to go to a different school. I thought I was going to go to LSU, actually, because just he was my first call. He called me every single week. We kind of developed a good relationship over the phone, and I liked, and then I took all 5 of my visits, and those were, taking all of them really helped me because I could see them. I went to A&M, and I absolutely fell in love with.
So let me ask this, if the coach at LSU built such a strong relationship, what made you go with A&M?
Yeah. So something that Bob McKinley, my coach at Nukes, he suggested, because he was a college coach, he was a college player, won NCAAs, both as a coach and player. He had suggested before I ever even started the process is to jot down, he said, put up, anything that you can think of that a college could help you with, or that can provide. So, I mean, he's like, that would be in your team, your coach, the strength of the program, academics, does it have your major, the dorms, the food, anything you could possibly think of. And he says, and then I want you to kind of narrow it down, and I want you to pick your top 5. And then once you do that, you're going to pick your top 3. And then you're going to put what's in order, what is your, now you're looking at your top 3, and you're not just top 3, but rank them. What's 1, 2, and 3 on your priority list? And on my priority list was not academics, surprise, surprise. And it wasn't, it was team was number 1.
Okay.
And then strength was number 2.
Strength
of the program, program. Yeah. Okay. So, were they competing at a high level? Were they, competing for conference tournament, going NCAAs every year, that kind of thing. And then coach was number 3. So you could see that out of everything that a college could provide for me, it was tennis was at the top of my priority list, but coach was number 3. And fascinatingly, I went and I really had enjoyed my relationship that I had built with the LSU coach. And, and some of the other coaches I really enjoyed too. it was just, there was, you know, I don't know. And when I ended up going, I went to A&M and I fell in love with the team. The team was so close that it didn't seem like there was all these little cliques and, you know, I just thought it was awesome. I thought it was, and so I came back and I went to Bob and I said, okay, I don't know what to do, because I really have found a connection with this coach at LSU and, you know, kind of a bond, but, I always thought that I was going to go there since July 1st, because I loved our first initial conversation and he was able to kind of say, okay, but Tiff, remember, go back to your priority list, go back to what it is that you were looking for. And, it was A&M checked off the top two and three. I mean, honestly, I loved my coach in A&M as well. It's just, you know, at the time when I was a senior in high school, it was kind of about bonds. And so that's kind of what helped.
And you get good guidance.
Yeah. And I tell people who are going through that college process who now are a little, you know, they're back and forth that they can't make these decisions and stuff. And I'm like, you know, this is the situation. This is what I have helped. What helps me, but
real quick, let's go back to the last piece of when you were in your junior 16, 14 mm-hmm. to 18, any injuries? Because I know there are parents mm-hmm. out there that their children have gotten hurt, and mm-hmm. there's not a lot, you know, for a tennis parent who their child has gotten hurt. They're like, imagine your kids on a baseball team. Mm-hmm. All the other, and their kid's good. All the other parents are like introducing you to doctors, and they have, mm-hmm. you have a support system. Tennis is so solo, even as a parent, that when kids do get hurt, a lot of times the parents don't even know where to turn. Yeah. So just hearing your experience, if you did have any injuries and how you dealt with them, will help those folks. So did you?
So I would consider myself quite lucky. I think that, you know, I got some shin splints throughout high school. And I did get a stress fracture. It was at the bottom of my by my ankle. So that put me out for a little while. I was in a boot, but you know, for the most part, I would consider myself quite lucky. I was out for, you know, some time. I still continued to work out. Unfortunately, it was my foot, or my ankle. So I couldn't do much. In a way, so I did a lot of swimming. You know, you're right, the tennis, I feel as though, you know, and we know also, there's really, tennis is a year-round, you know, it's continual. There's no season, right? And so sometimes I think we definitely put pressure on ourselves or feel the pressure of going, oh my gosh, all these kids are playing this, and, you know, my child is not, or I'm not as the player. And you know, it can create some anxiety, certainly. But I think just keeping in mind that this is a long journey and it's a process, and just trying to get healthy and stay healthy is key. So, I mean, missing a couple of tournaments or missing a quote unquote kind of season, but there's really not, you know, it's a struggle to get back, because you're right, you're by yourself. And if those ranking points drop and it's harder to get into tournaments, and now you're kind of having to kind of battle back a little bit, it can be a struggle. But I mean, maintaining a healthy mind, quite honestly, is what's going to help those moments. But yeah, it's tough. I got pretty lucky in my junior career with not too many serious injuries.
Yeah, I try to remind parents every once in a while, you know, you look at Klay Thompson on the Golden State Warriors, he tears his ACL, then he tears his Achilles, he's out for almost 2 years, and then he comes back and wins an NBA championship. If you're good, you'll always be good. Once you get back to playing, it'll be okay. This idea of we're losing ground and all that, I think there may be some truth to it, but I think good players are good players regardless of how much time they sit out because of an injury. Federer sat out at 1.6 months and then comes back and wins when he comes back. You had a stress fracture in your ankle. You took time off, you came back, and you were still good when you came back. It didn't go away.
Yeah, totally.
The path to coming back is hard. It's tough, but you're going to get there eventually. All right, Scott, what questions have you got?
Well, just want to talk a little bit about your college career. You know, you talked about choosing Texas A&M. How did you enjoy A&M, and was it the right choice for you at the end of the road, at the end of the day?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it was, you know, it's 4 years of development, right? And it's 4 years of continuing to, you know, and I try to tell parents, kids, coaches, you know, that it's like, you still have 4 years. It, you know, you're far from done. A lot of times everyone, okay, get through your path by 18, and it's like, okay, done. It's like, no. 4 years is a long time to continue to develop and get better. And I love it. College is probably brought back the love that I maybe lost a little along the way in juniors, to be honest with you. Loved playing for a team, loved A&M. A&M had, you know, has tons of money, it was a great fit for me. The team was great. I was pretty set on line five singles. I don't know why, it just sort of kind of happened that way. I obviously played four through six, but five was kind of my spot. And then my sophomore year, and in doubles, I was a good doubles player, but I, you know, I had good hands. I liked coming in. I serve in volley. You know, I return and come in. I don't, you know, that was just kind of my game. And they kind of struggled with kind of where to put me. You know, do I stay at line three and carry somebody, which I was doing for a while, and then, or do you put me somewhere else? But players were kind of established, and it was my sophomore year, I remember. And a lot of people were like, well, try to put Tiffany at one, you know, see what happens if she goes to line one with, you know, this, actually a girl from Kentucky. Her name was Sarah Foster, and she played at Kentucky, and she transferred over to A&M. So I said, try and put them together. And I think we had not played much. And it was a struggle, and we were going in to play Georgia. Georgia had a team that was like, I want to say they were top five in the country, number one doubles team. And we were in the locker room, and the coach, you know, says the lineup, and we're kind of not halfway through the season, but kind of. And, you know, we're struggling in the doubles department, and he calls out the lineup, and he's like, you know, all right, line three. And everyone's thinking it's Tiffany and someone, and he doesn't say my name. I go, what? Line two is going to be the, you know, the set two team that, you know, we're never going to break up. Line one, we're going to put Tiffany and Sarah. What? Tiffany and Sarah going to play Georgia? You know, this team is, we barely practice together. I don't, you know, is this right? We go out and we play and we beat this team. And from there on out, I got to solidify my spot at line one, which was nice. And then Sarah and I, you know, we had only started a little bit halfway through the season, but we had gotten enough wins to be able to go to NCAAs as a doubles team. And then we stayed together the next year and did the same thing until she graduated. So I loved it. I loved every minute of it. You know, being able to play at that level and to go to NCAAs. And, you know, it was always fun for me that I was like, I was playing line one double, so you're playing on the show court, and then it's like in singles, like, yeah, I'm going to go down to court five, which is perfect for me. Like, it was good. I loved it because it was, you know, I love doubles, and I love the fast-pacedness of it, and I liked, you know, we're all on three courts. It felt fast. It felt, you know, the crowd is all together, and at A&M, the crowds were something that is remembering. People who go to A&M, who went to A&M, I have not been there in a while, but who have gone to A&M, the crowds are what is awesome. I mean, we had over 1,000 people at one of our matches, and this is a women's tennis college match.
Wow.
So, I mean, we played A&M versus Texas, and that was obviously, we were rivals, and I think it was a little over 1,000 people in attendance that match. So to play in that crowd in that setting, it was really fun. And College Station is just a college town, as you know. So there's not much. So people go and support the athletics, which is really fun.
Let me ask Scott, do you want to ask anything else about college before I ask a question about what's happening now?
Well, I wanted to ask one question. It's not about college, but I wanted to circle back on, you mentioned that your mom would get physically sick watching your matches. Mm-hmm. And why was that? Was that she was so concerned about the results, or what was the reason for that?
Yep. You hit it. Yeah. It was very result oriented, and that, yeah. And then that's, unfortunately, because I had gotten pretty good, right, and I started to have, some success, I think she saw that again as kind of my way out of the situation that we were in. You know, we lived in a pretty bad area. She didn't have a lot of money. My dad doesn't have any, a lot of money. And I picked a somewhat expensive sport that I'm actually okay at. And so she knows that if you win, then you continue to get opportunities and progress. And so, yeah, it was unfortunately, because I traveled a lot by myself, I would call her and I would say, I play this, I'd be at hard courts and I said, okay. She'd say, how did you do? And I said, I won. And she goes, okay, when's your next match? So that would be like our conversation. And then if I ever lost, I would obviously dread that phone call. And it would be a, 15, 20 minute yelling at me over the phone about all kinds of stuff, about how bad I am or how I'm not going to have these opportunities if I don't win. And, so I developed this, I try to tell, yes, grit, but I also unfortunately developed I was competing out of fear. And so I won a ton of matches, and my brother goes, well, whatever, Tiffany, you were good. You won all these matches. I said, yeah, I won them because I was scared to lose. It was not because I wanted to win. And there's a difference. I didn't even care about winning at the time. I just didn't want to lose. So I didn't get in trouble. So I didn't get hit. So I didn't get yelled at. So I didn't, so I wasn't made to run until I threw up. That's why I was, that's why I was winning matches, is because I just didn't want to lose. So not healthy, by the way, not healthy at all. And certainly not on a child, and certainly when it's coming from a parent. So, but that definitely was.
Yeah, that's better. Super interesting. And, it goes back to the thing where we're trying to create adversity, but you see, it's not healthy. It's definitely not healthy to have that mentality where you're afraid to lose. But it is a motivator, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you do see a lot of kids succeed in those kind of environments that you wouldn't want to put your kids in. So that's a really tough balance to handle. And I'm curious, as a tennis mom now, mm-hmm. how do you be a better tennis mom than your mom was?
Yeah. That is a question that I have pondered since before I was pregnant, probably. So, and I don't know that I'm doing it right. I try to be there, as a support. I have one daughter who's in competitive gymnastics, which is a whole nother beast. And then one daughter who's in competitive tennis. And, I think thankfully I've had the bad, right? So you can learn from what you don't want to do. And I'll be very honest with you guys. It was we're in May. So about 5 months ago, 4 months ago, maybe, my daughter, who was 10 at the time, but she's on this path of kind of, she's playing her first L3 at, at age 10. She's on a decent path. I know she is. I know what this looks like. So I know as a parent, I got myself a little she's on this path. She wants to do this. She's telling me she wants to do this. So I need to try to help make a push. Like, not me, I can't hit the ball for her, but I'm going to make a push I'm going to find tournaments for her. I'm going to find opportunities for her. And it was actually too much. And I didn't know that at the time, and again, because I'm seeing she's progressing, she's playing all the tournaments, I feel like she's a couple matches away from kind of breaking through in these, and she's getting in and she's doing well. And she said to me, and she started crying this one tournament, she was you know, playing. And she was like, I just feel like this is too much. And I said, whoa. And it made me take like a major step back and say, like, and reflect and say, oh my gosh, I'm not putting out, she's not in trouble. It's not result oriented. I'm not doing that kind of thing. But was I pushing too much in the sense of like, did I become too hyper in this process? Did I become too hyperactive and say, okay, all right, what's next? And what's going, okay, you got this, you just finished here. Now, what are we going to do now? Did I become that? I think so. And it helped, and her and I, unfortunately, her and I have a great relationship. We can, she is open with me. And she said, you know, the way I know I'm not doing it like my mom was, is my daughter wants me to watch her, thankfully. She wants to talk to me. She wants to open up. But it did make me sort of go, okay, I need to take a step back here as a parent. She was driving this, but now did I start driving it a little bit more? Am I the one who's, and so it made me reflect. And, you know, it's those moments that I'm not perfect, right? And I tell her she's not perfect, where we make mistakes. And that day, what's interesting is she did that. She goes, I feel like it's a little bit too much. And I said, okay, let's take the week off. Like take tennis off for all. You don't have to play. Don't play because you think I want you to, or, you know. And so it's funny, like that week we went and hit golf balls. We went and, you know, do I want my daughter to quit tennis? No. But not because I want her to be a superstar. I don't want her to quit tennis because I think tennis has a lot to offer. Not, you know, it's just a great sport. So,
yeah, I don't know. A lot of times I say the kids have to want it more than we want it for them.
Yep.
But what I would tell you is telling that story you just told, there are a whole bunch of tennis parents out there going, even somebody who had the junior and college mm-hmm. career Tiffany had, who now works for USTA, still, when it comes to their own child, struggles with it. Because yeah. there is no right way to do it, because every kid's different. And so yeah. I think your pathway was one pathway. Every kid has their own pathway. What I love is that you are open with what you're experiencing, because now every parent can breathe a sigh of relief and go, man, this is hard. And how mm-hmm. I decide to do it is different than how Tiffany decides to do it or anybody else. And we just got to find what works for our own individual child. You know, for me, yeah. You know, my child, I tell him all the time, if you don't want to play tennis anymore, I don't care. Quit. Mm-hmm. Because I'm trying to create a culture in him that it's his thing. And you know him, and I think you know it is his thing. But what I do have followed up since he was 8 saying is, but if you do quit, you're going to have to find something else that you work to be number one in the world at. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what that is, mm-hmm. right? But we're not going to sit around and eat Cheetos and watch TV and play video games. So
yeah.
The reality is the only non-negotiable for me is we're going to work hard to be great at something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's all you're saying.
Yeah, totally. And it's what's funny is we were at the tennis tournament in that story, and, you know, and she was done. She had lost I think it was a compass draw. She won her last match or something, but it was a bad tournament for her, rough. And she was kind of saying that. And I said, hey, listen, yeah, you don't want to play. You don't have to play. But I said, you will have to find something though. And that is why I was like, okay. She goes, okay, well, can I try golf? I said, sure, let's go play. You know, you let me know, like, we can go hit some golf balls. Okay, let's go hit some golf balls. Okay. Well, golf lasted about a week or less yep. than. And she was like, no, nah, I don't want to do this. I'm like, okay, totally fine. She, you know, and she is, I miss tennis or whatever it was, which is great. We needed to go through that. And
mine, when he was 10, I bought him a set of clubs. He fell in love, and he came to me one day and he says, Dad, I got to talk to you. I think I want to quit tennis and play golf. And I was like, all right, go for it, man. And about a week later, just like you said, he came back. Cause I always say kids gravitate towards what they're good at. Mm-hmm. And he realized, I'm getting my butt whipped by all these other kids. I don't want to play this. I like being able to win, you know?
Right. So,
that's a great story. Funny. And parents have to be okay when they say that with, all right, go ahead. and let them figure out maybe that was a bad idea for themselves instead of us telling them.
That's hilarious. Yep, that's exactly it. That's exactly what happened. So my daughter's back to playing tennis every day. So we're, but you know, it's what, you know, what I learned as a tennis parent in that moment though, is that yes, I needed to take a step back and it helped me sort of reflect and it allowed space for her to kind of find herself again. And, you know, we're talking, you know, my daughter's just turned 11 and we're just now kind of starting to talk about identity, right? And this is in tennis, everyone has a game identity and she doesn't quite know what her game identity is yet, although she thinks she kind of does. But I'm now even just, and as a female, I don't know if it's different. I don't have boys, but I now, you know, that was also part of our conversation is just creating an identity for herself is saying, okay, you know, let's start I want you to start defining, you know, things about yourself and what are you, who are you? And, you know,
In other words, your identity can't be solely in tennis or every time you lose, it's the end of the world.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. And, you know, these kids are young, all these kids, they're kids at the end of the day too. So, I mean, and fortunately she, you know, she's at a tennis academy right now, here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's a great resource for her. It's a great spot for her. She has, it's, you know, I'd rather her be involved with the group that's there than, you know, out making poor decisions somewhere else.
Right? Yeah, good crew of kids to be around on a daily basis.
Great group and great coaches and great, I mean, it's just a great environment. And, you know, we live in Tulsa where it's a pretty big tennis town actually. And, very family oriented. So I've got lucky. I mean, we're so lucky and she knows it, you know, she's lucky. We're lucky. And yeah.
Well, Tiffany, I want you to know, I was texting Scott while we were talking. This has been one of my favorite podcasts to do. Just because I think your story's so interesting and there's so many parents out there that are going to connect with everything that you said. Appreciate you not holding back and being honest. And I think so many, Scott, don't you agree? I mean, there's going to be so many people that love this episode.
I want to say I was really frustrated with Tiffany because every time I had a question I wanted to ask, she was already answering it. So she was on top of the agenda. So I like to say, I agree. Well, you didn't even fantastic story. I love everything that she said today.
Me too.
And tennis has been my life, right? You guys, I've been playing since I was 8. It's what got me an opportunity to go get a college degree. And then right out of college, I mean, I was 22 taking my first job with the USTA. So, and now I'm a tennis parent and now, you know, I've coached, I've worn, you know, I try to tell people I've worn every single hat that you can put on in the game. So as a player, as a beginner, as a junior, as an adult league player, as a coach, as a parent, you know, as a college player, as an ITF player, is, you know, anything that you can think of, I've seen some part of it or experienced it. So, it's good though. And I'm fortunate.
Here's my question with you saying that. We always finish with, if people want to get a hold of you, how do they get a hold of you? And I'm not saying give your cell phone number. I'm saying if you have an email, if you have any professional way for which you want, if they have questions, would like to follow up, how would they get a hold of you if you want them to?
Absolutely. People contact me all the time and I'd be more than happy to. My USTA email is my kind of professional email and that's T Milner. It's my last name is MILNER @ITA, which is the Intermountain Tennis Association, .USTA.com. So T Milner @ITA.USTA.com. And I mean, I'm happy to, I talk to parents all the time. I talk to coaches, I talk to players. Fortunately I know the world of the USTA pathway. I've been working with the USTA for 15 years. So I've seen it kind of come full circle and evolve into what it is now. So I try to help and be a resource there. And then, you know, obviously here in Tulsa, as just a tennis parent, I try to be a resource for all those people around me here too.
Well, again, thanks for being on. Scott, anything before we wrap?
Oh, thanks so much, Tiffany. I hope to see you soon.
Of course. Well, thank you guys. I really appreciate you.